From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her book, Drinking in America, Susan Cheever examines what she sees as the tension between two different poles, drinking on one hand and temperance on the other. There was a time when the U.S. was the drunkest country in the world, but we've also seen times in history when we were the least drunk. It's a pendulum swing that she documents, and it's full of stories of famous Americans who also happen to be pretty decent drinkers. The real insight in the book is how alcohol played a critical role in the country we became. Cheever argues booze fueled our revolutionary attitude. It gave us courage and purpose. And she'll join us today to explain that, like it or not, you cannot separate the American national character from our history with alcohol. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By 1820, in this country, we were doing a lot of drinking. In her book, the historian Susan Cheever explains that it took us a while to get there. It started with beer. The pilgrims drank a lot of beer. Then we switched to rum and then corn whiskey and cider, lots of cider. By 1820, Cheever says the average amount one person would drink in one day was three times the average of today. School children drank before school. They even drank at school. Farmers drank all day. So did factory workers. It was a fact of life. And right around this time, we were the drunkest country in the world. And then the pendulum began to swing in a different direction. And that's the pattern Cheever identifies in her book. Two poles, drinking on one end and abstinence on the other. Liquor, sobriety. Addiction, recovery. And she's been interested in these subjects for years now, but it wasn't until recently that she realized the story of America was the collision of those two poles. So, yes, you'll find a ton of drinking in the American story. And it's a critical theme in the book, by the way, the influence of alcohol on the country we became, the national character. But the U.S. is also the birthplace for some of the most effective temperance movements. And don't forget prohibition. Today in the program, Susan Cheever is joining us. Her book is Drinking in America, Our Secret History. She's a biographer and historian, among other things. She's written about E.E. Cummings and Bill Wilson. He was the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's the author of five novels, four memoirs, and she's joining us today from NPR in New York. And Susan Cheever, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. Nice intro.
Thanks. I want to start with, you mentioned that an historian needs to lay out on the table your sense of your biases. So let's start there. You've studied alcohol and alcoholism for years now. Your father, of course, the great writer John Cheever, was an alcoholic. You've written about your own struggles with alcoholism. So let's start there. What influence did all of that have on the way, not just you were seeing the history that you were studying, but your interest in studying it at all?
Well, I think for me, at least, writing comes out of obsession. If I'm not obsessed with something, I'm not going to be able to write about it. So for a long time, since I can remember, since I was able to identify what was happening in the house where I grew up as related to alcoholism, I've been obsessed with drinking and how it helps people and how it hurts people. So obsessed with sort of trying to figure it out, which of course we haven't figured it out yet. Right. So that's one sort of rolling obsession. And then more recently in the last 20 years, although in a way it started in college, I became obsessed with American history. Mm-hmm. And so those two obsessions, when I realized that those two obsessions collided, I thought, oh, this is it. This is it. I have to write about this. I have to write about the place where drinking and recovery or drinking and temperance collide with American history. So I started reading American history with an eye to picking out the drinking part of it.
Right.
And, you know, the drinking part of it turned out to be huge. Yeah. I mean, I was very surprised. The research for this book featured me sitting on the library floor going, oh my God, over and over again. As I discovered in these books, because I do my research in library stacks, I don't know how people do research otherwise, as I discovered over and over again how drinking had affected American history. So part of the joy of writing the book was finding out over and over again how many things in American history had to do with drinking. I had no idea, for instance, that Senator Joseph McCarthy and all that Red Scare, House Un-American Activities stuff had to do with his alcoholism. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that Richard Nixon had had an alcohol problem. I didn't – you know, there were so many things I didn't know about. And so in researching the book, its premise became more and more convincing to me.
I read where you had said in this interview that you trained your kids to read the New York Times and go, okay, where's the drink in this story? Would you talk about that, just the sense that – and why is it that the drink and sometimes the sex and sometimes the sort of warts of history aren't in history books?
Well, I think the sex – anyway, let me go back to your question. Yeah. People kind of clear the room when I go to read the New York Times in the morning because almost inevitably there's a rant from me about the role of drinking in some news story or other. Yeah. And, you know, I certainly wonder, for instance, with Justice Scalia, if there was – you know, I wonder how much he drank.
Yeah.
So I'm always looking for that. And – you know, a much better example, an example that I can certainly talk about more knowledgeably, is the relationship of drinking to the sexual assault problem on college campuses. Really, we may not have a sexual assault problem. We may just have a drinking problem on college campuses and on campuses where there is no alcohol. And I think Dartmouth is the only one. It's made a huge difference in terms of sexual assault. So I'm always reading the news and thinking, whoa, this is really a drinking story and it hasn't been reported that way. So, you know, as I go through the newspaper and rant and rave about what's being left out, people do leave the room, including my children. Although, you know, they've learned to do it themselves in a quieter way. I don't know. Do you think sex gets left out? I'm not so sure. I just know that over and over and over there'll be a story, a domestic violence story, a sexual assault story, you know, a crime story sometimes, an early death story, and the drinking part of it doesn't get reported. Certainly also there are positive stories where the drinking part of it doesn't get reported.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to make sure, and you did this very nicely, that people understood about the book is it's not saying that drinking is bad, not at all.
Yeah.
It's saying that drinking is powerful, 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 and that it's also very invisible in our accounts of our history.
Some of this, the book, is kind of this exploration of what you call the American character. Or maybe it's just human nature more broadly, you know, subject to these wild extremes. We love it, we hate it. It's the solution, it's the problem. Is that a particularly American thing, do you think? I mean, how much of this is just such an American story?
I think it's a totally American story. I really, you know, when it comes to drinking in Europe or drinking in Russia, I couldn't resist the business about the Tsar outlawing vodka and Tolstoy pleading with him not to do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the most part, I don't know anything about European history. I mean, I may know a little, but, you know, I know the basic liberal education stuff about European history, but I do know quite a lot about American history. So I don't feel qualified to talk about how it works in Europe. I'm just sure that it works differently because everything does work differently. I mean, America, as we all know, is a very unusual country because of the vast amounts of land we have, because of its youth, because of the way it grew up, because of the influence of the frontier, because of because it was started by Protestant dissenters for many, many, many reasons. The American character is very different from, say, the French character or, you know, the Ukrainian character. So, and that's the American character is the one that I know about and that I have some sense about. So I really tried to restrict myself to that.
There's this kind of this is such an obvious question, but do you think you understand what it is about alcohol that's so beguiling? I mean, it's you know, it can dull our senses, it can act as a diversion, it can be social. I mean, it can be all of those things at once. But
it's totally beguiling.
Yeah. Yeah, so
beguiling is such a great word. And in fact, in many ways I think it's the most beguiling of the addictive substances because even sugar makes you fat, you know, but alcohol just makes you happy.
Right.
So, and drugs, you know, those are bad and they're illegal. So alcohol is really the most beguiling, I think, of the addictive substances because it's not illegal and it's smiled upon and it's the way we celebrate in this country and it's the way we take the edge off things and it's the way, it's the tool we use to get through the, you know, the pain and sweetness of life. And yes, I think I do understand how beguiling it is. The thing that interests me is not just that it's beguiling, but that it's invisible.
Right.
That's the weird thing. In other words, when you have a whole community, say, using heroin, everybody knows it.
Yeah.
Everybody sees it. It gets reported. It's a horrible thing. But when you have a whole community that's so drunk at night that they don't really remember anything, everybody thinks it's fine. I don't, you know, everybody's a weird word. But there's a kind of invisibleness to alcohol, the way there is to food, the way there is to breathing, that fascinates me. Hmm. And also there's tremendous resistance to the idea that we should look at our drinking. I just was down at the NIH speaking about alcoholism. And in the audience, and this was certainly not a drunken audience, right? It was an audience who had come to something at the National Institutes of Health to hear about alcoholism. Mm-hmm. Two or three or four people got very bent out of shape over the fact that the NIH defines binge drinking as more than four drinks an hour, bringing your blood alcohol level to 0.08, right?
Yeah.
Now, that definition is totally arbitrary, as they're happy to admit. But there were people in the audience going, don't you call that binge drinking? I do that. That's not binge drinking.
Right.
So there's a tremendous amount of kind of adorable defensiveness around drinking that, you know, sometimes I think we have an epidemic of alcoholism in this country. So nice, I think we have an epidemic of defiance.
Well, that's it. That's really such a critical theme in the book, this idea of, and we'll get to this as we go along, but on one hand, damn it, we're Americans and we have the freedom to be able to do this. I mean, that's such a critical part of the
yes.
of the story. And also there's this, as you put it in the book, there's the alcoholic sweet spot. That at low doses, alcohol causes these bursts of creativity. I mean, it plays out in American history and in moments of, you know, our sense of, again, we'll talk about this, our sense of defiance, our sense of art and literature. It's played out at certain times as well. And so, but then it can overwhelm us, you know. So at some point, it's fine, it's good, it drives our character. And then at some point it can destroy us. So that's sort of such an important theme in the book, I think.
I think it is. I mean, I think for most people, alcohol is fine. But for those 10 or 15% of people for whom it's not, who for whatever reasons, and, you know, the neuroscientists have one explanation and the, you know, religious groups have another, for whatever reason, for between 10 and 15% of the population, it's not fine.
Yeah.
And at some point it becomes not fine. And why, you know, it's not fine for them and fine for the next guy, that's still pretty mysterious.
Yeah, you say there's still a mystery at the heart of alcohol's effects.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why Alcoholics Anonymous has to say it's a self-diagnosed disease. In other words, you're an alcoholic if you say you are, right. and you're not an alcoholic if you say you're not. And that's their way around this mystery, because really, you know, there certainly are symptoms, but it's hard to know who's an alcoholic, and it's almost impossible to know who's going to be an alcoholic. There's a genetic component. That's certainly true. There's some kind of childhood trauma component. But still, plenty of people with alcoholic parents who had bad childhoods are not alcoholic. So there is still a kind of mystery, both at the heart of what creates an alcoholic and at the heart of what can put an alcoholic into recovery.
Yeah. The story of America is that sort of pendulum swing, as I mentioned in the introduction that you write about. You know, so in the 1830s, we're the drunkest country in the world, and then the pendulum eventually swings, and we come up with prohibition, and then it swings back. And in the 50s and 60s, we're awash in alcohol, as you put it. But and we'll talk about some of the particulars along the way, but where are we today, do you figure? I mean, there's lots of laws, decent social constraints, but it's still a big problem, you say.
Well, you know, when I was writing the book, this is such a good question, because the answer is ultimately I have no idea. But let me, as we say, unpack that.
Yeah.
When I was writing the book, I thought that we were headed back towards prohibition.
Right.
It seemed to me 5 years ago that we were narrowing the things that one was allowed to do in polite society. You clearly weren't allowed to smoke anymore. And you used to be allowed, you know, to drink quite a lot, and you're not allowed to be drunk anymore. It's not okay to be drunk, even at a dinner party. And it's not okay to be visibly high. And I thought, well, we're going back towards this mistaken idea that you can legislate addiction, which was the idea behind prohibition. So I thought, you know, I have to write this book to say to people, no, 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 this does not work. You cannot legislate addiction. We will not be able, you know, by telling people they have to drink less, by making it harder for them to drink in the way that we've made it harder for them to smoke, we will not be able to control things in this way. Let's please look at our history and remember that this doesn't work. But now, the picture is very, very mixed. I mean, there's this tremendous opiate addiction going on. And that's very intertwined with alcohol. You know, I mean, those things go together. I think it's very hard to be addicted to opiates if you don't drink at all. And as you know, that's caused the life expectancy of, you know, middle class white people is the one that's going down or up, whichever one I'm saying. In other words, there's that tremendous opiate addiction, the tremendous heroin addiction that's going on in New England that's really destroying our New England villages, our New England heritage. And there's more drinking, literally drink for drink. We're drinking more than we drank 10 years ago. So it's a very confusing picture right now. It isn't what I thought. I had thought that by the time this book came out, drinking would be more and more stigmatized, addictions of all kinds would be more and more stigmatized, and that I needed to say to people, hey, stigmatizing these things doesn't work. We need to find another way. That is not what's happening.
I wonder where the sort of recreational use of marijuana and legalizing marijuana, does that play
That's
into
That's another factor.
That, yeah.
You've got the opiate addiction thing going on that has to do with prescription drugs. You've got the heroin epidemic going on in New England. You've got marijuana being legalized in many places. And you've got people drinking more. So it's wild. It's not what, you know, as I say, 5 years ago when I started writing this book, this was not what I expected. And it's hard to know what to say about it except that, you know, addiction, we do have treatment for addiction. We do have treatment for alcoholism. We do have treatment for these things. And it's a tragic and dreadful aspect of our society today that most people who need that treatment do not get that treatment. Mm. I can say that much.
Yeah.
You know, in the recovery community, they say that 10% of people who need treatment get treatment. Now, that's a scandal. And it's for a variety of reasons. It's because addiction is invisible. It's because the insurance companies don't want to finance treatment, even though legally they're bound to. It's for a lot of different reasons. But really, we do have treatment that works, and people need to get to it.
Susan Cheever.
I went right off topic.
No. You didn't go off topic. I mean, we're heading back to history when we get back from a break. How's that?
Okay.
Susan Cheever is with us. Her book is Drinking in America, Our Secret History. And we'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the relationship between Americans and alcohol. We're talking with the historian Susan Cheever about her book, Drinking in America, Our Secret History. She has written a book that looks at the influence of drinking on history, how it has changed events. It fuels vibrant bursts of creativity. It made us rebellious, gave us attitude, but it also, throughout our history, has made us sloppy and unhealthy. So we go back and forth on this pendulum. Susan Cheever is joining us from NPR in New York. Well, let's talk about the Mayflower. This is a great story, I have to say. So in 1620, it really is this little tidbit that the Pilgrims basically landed in Cape Cod rather than Virginia where they were supposed to, not because that's where they intended, but because they were running out of beer.
Exactly.
They drank a lot of beer.
And, you know, in 1620, to be fair, everybody thought that water was undrinkable.
Right.
It was not undrinkable, but nobody drank it. And, you know, perhaps in some places because of primitive sewage systems, it was dangerous to drink. But, you know, in most of the world, it was imminently drinkable, but people didn't drink it.
Yeah.
So instead of water, they drank beer. So running out of beer was a serious thing. It meant dehydration, scurvy, all kinds of terrible things, as well as sobriety. So yes, they were very, very concerned.
Well, talk about kind of beer. I mean, this was pretty potent stuff.
It was 0.6. And it was a gallon a day for every man, woman, and child on the Mayflower. So, you know, it was a pretty happy ship. although everything that could go wrong went wrong for the Mayflower.
Yeah.
And, of course, I don't want to say that's because they were drinking so much beer, but sometimes those things go together. But, yes, they finally, after a horrendous voyage, they started 4 months late. They lost one of their ships, mm-hmm. the Speedwell. They ended up, you know, with twice as many passengers as they thought they were going to have. And then they had a grueling voyage across the Atlantic. Of course, it was in September and October, not the right months. You know, a huge beam broke in the middle of the Atlantic, and the captain wanted to turn back, and they found a way to repair it. So when they finally saw the dunes of Cape Cod, it was a huge relief. And, you know, but they knew they weren't supposed to land on Cape Cod. They knew that their charter from King James was for Northern Virginia, and they knew that they had to sail south. But they were running out of beer. So they made one pass at sailing south, and they couldn't get past Monomoy, which is the elbow of Cape Cod. And they just decided, you know, we're going to have to land. So they rounded. They went into Provincetown Harbor, which is not a good harbor, in November, which is not a good month. And they made such a bad landing that they had to wade in. So it was sort of a disaster, that landing, in so many ways. And just to mention, Provincetown Harbor is halfway between two of the great harbors in the world, New York and Boston. So in many ways, landing in Provincetown Harbor and then finally getting across to Plymouth was not the Pilgrims' most brilliant series of moves.
Right. Well, you're right.
How's
about
that?
There's this difference in attitude about drinking between the Pilgrims and then, of course, the Puritans. I mean, basically, it's the sort of the pro-drinkers and the anti-drinkers. And you're right about how these factions would create these as you put it in the book, these ideas and these identities that would flow throughout American history. So those two strains of American belief, one that we have a right to drink if we want, it's a basic liberty, and the other one is you need to stop drinking for the interest of the community, right? Is that basically it?
Well, but what makes it even better, I mean, the Puritans loved to drink. Yeah. They were not going to run out of beer. I mean, the Winthrop fleet was loaded down with beer and rum and whiskey. That's the Puritans who came 10 years after the Pilgrims and who came in force, the poor old Pilgrims. You know, there were only 108 of them. Right. The Puritans came in 12 ships, and there were hundreds of them, and many of them were distinguished men, and they brought a ton, literally, of liquor. They learned from the Pilgrims. But the interesting thing is that what was true then is also true now. You know, I think it was Cotton Mather who said that liquor, that beer, that liquor, that drinking is a good creature of God. You know, this was thought to be a wonderful gift, mm-hmm. that there were liquids that could elevate your spirits in the way that that booze can, and yet they hated drunkenness.
Right.
Drunkenness was from the devil. Woe be to drunkards, and so it was as if they didn't want to connect the drinking with the effect of the drinking. And we still have that now. It's so funny because it isn't like one group thought drinking was great and one group thought drinking was terrible, although that happened as well. It's that the same group thought the same thing was great until it was terrible.
Right.
So you can't really – I mean, how can you espouse drunkenness without – espousing its effect. You know, it's like people eating a lot and wondering why they're fat. I mean, there's just no – it doesn't make any sense that drinking can be great and that drunkenness can be evil. But that's what they did.
Yeah.
They embraced this idea that drinking was fantastic and wonderful and good for everybody. And then when people got drunk and fell down and did stupid things – they acted as if the person had been possessed by the devil. So it's sort of a strange blind dichotomy that we still have in this country. Mm. Do you know? I mean, still people think it's great to have a few drinks, but then they're horrified if somebody's drunk.
Would you talk about – this is, again, an important part of the book, I think, the way you talked about the influence of drinking on what happened in our history. So talk about what was going on in early American taverns, because it seems like our sense of defiance, our kind of working out of these ideas of personal liberty and identity are all sort of playing out in places where we gathered to drink, basically, right?
Yes. Well, certainly one of the things that happened in this country, and it was a little bit true in England, but not nearly to the extent it became true here, is that the first building that got built in every town was the tavern.
Yeah.
And the tavern often served as the courthouse, as the church, and of course, as the tavern. So that meant that many of the functions of government were, you know, conducted under the influence. Mm. I mean, you're in a tavern. What are you going to do? So, you know, there were more taverns than churches, and the tavern became the center of New England village life. And so when people began to be upset with the way that they were being ruled by a very far away king with really spectacularly inept representatives, they gathered in the taverns to talk about it. And in Boston especially, they gathered in the Green Dragon Tavern, which was famously the heart of the American Revolution.
Yeah.
The Sons of Liberty were born in the Green Dragon Tavern. The Boston Tea Party was planned in the Green Dragon Tavern. So – and of course, it was a tavern. You know, there weren't other building – there weren't coffee houses in the way that, say, there are now. So much of our early history – came out of those taverns. I mean, my favorite is that, you know, they had not the Boston Tea Party, they had planned to go out to the three tea ships and secure the tee to nail it down so that it couldn't be unloaded, because the British had a rule that if something wasn't unloaded for 90 days, it had to go back to England.
Yeah.
And since the colonists didn't want to pay the tax on the tee, they didn't want the tee to be unloaded. But they got out to the ships to secure the tee, and they were somewhat dressed up in these silly costumes, and they just thought, why not just throw it overboard?
Right.
You know? And I mean, there's no record that they were drunk, but, you know, they had been hanging out discussing this in the Green Dragon Tavern, and it just seems to me like the kind of thing you would do after a couple, three, four beers. Why
right.
not just throw it overboard? Come on, guys.
Throw it in the bay. Yeah.
And that's what they did,
yeah.
you know, to great effect. And so many of our historic moments were fueled or changed by drinking. I mean, Paul Revere famously stopped at Isaac Hall's for a drink on his ride. And, you know, when he got to Lexington, maybe this is my favorite story in the book. Paul Revere gets to Lexington. The militia turn out. There are about 70 of them. It's about midnight. He says, the British are coming, the British are coming. But, of course, the British aren't coming. The British are very weighed down. The British are barely past Charleston. So the 70 guys who are the colonial army at that point assemble on the Lexington Green, and it becomes clear that the British aren't coming for quite a while. So they all go to Buckman's Tavern, which is still there, to wait for the British to come. So between about midnight and about 3 a.m., the militia, the colonial army, is in Buckman's Tavern. So the British finally arrive at about 3 a.m., feeling really angry that they haven't been able to mount a surprise attack, and angry that they've had to march all night. And to be a British soldier was a nightmare. You had 50 pounds of gear, and it was just they had to march in formation. And so the militia staggers out of Buckman's Tavern to confront the British. And the British have been told by Paul Revere that it's a well-armed army of 300 people. In fact, it's a somewhat under the influence, under the weather army of about 70 people. And that encounter between the drunken militia and the kind of uptight, overloaded, information British, the militia being drunk, the British not being drunk, I just find hilarious. It doesn't end well. They've both been told not to fire the first shot, and the British just go nuts. They have an Al-Anon meltdown. They start screaming at the militia and going, huzzah, huzzah, and grabbing them and shaking them, do you know? But finally, someone does fire a shot, probably from the window of Buckman's Tavern, and then the British just mow the militia down. And that's actually the first shots of the Revolutionary War, not the first shots that happen in Concord the next day, which are so memorialized. So, you know, I just think it's not a funny story because many people die, but it's interesting how alcohol had a huge effect on that night, the night of the 17th of April in 1775. So, yeah, over and over again, alcohol has a huge effect. I mean, Ethan Allen, you know, as a child, I was fascinated by this story of Fort Ticonderoga. I mean, here's this guy. I didn't know as a child that he was drunk, but of course he was. At 3 a.m, he arrives with a few ragtag troops and takes this major fort just by walking in and going up to the bedroom of the commandant and saying, either I take this fort in the name of the colonial army or come out of there, you damn rat, depending on who you believe. And the commandant, of course, he's British. He has to put his hair up in combs and he has these special pants and gaiters. He's not even half dressed. And he gives the fort up to Ethan Allen. And, you know, what a great example of how what we call Dutch courage.
Right. Well,
here's
my favorite story, at least of Ethan
Allen. Okay.
And maybe it's got to be apocryphal. It can't be true. The story of the rattlesnake. Will you tell that story?
Well, it can't be true. You're
yeah.
right. But Ethan Allen was famous for being drunk. He was a proud, proud drunk. And occasionally people would try to reason with him and tell him he was drinking too much, and he didn't want to hear that. And his favorite story, and the favorite story about him, is that he and a friend were taking a nap in the sun one day, and the friend looked over, and a rattlesnake had crawled up on Ethan Allen's belly and was biting him. And then as the friend watched, it became clear that the rattlesnake was getting drunk from Ethan Allen's blood. Talk about blood alcohol. And the rattlesnake sort of started slithering around and going, whoopee, or whatever is the rattlesnake version of whoopee, and kind of slid off Ethan Allen's body and looped away as a drunken rattlesnake might. And, of course, when Ethan Allen woke up, he was like, what are all these bites? Are these big mosquitoes or something? So, you know, in the story, the drink also inoculated him against the rattlesnake's poison. But I do like the idea of a drunken rattlesnake, yes.
Yeah. Before we head to a break, so we'll shift gears away from the Revolutionary War. But there are a lot of great stories. John Adams, John and Abigail Adams, and really the tragedy of alcohol encountered in their family.
Oh, that's such a sad story.
It's a really sad story. Say something about George Washington. I mean, you mentioned that he was an enthusiastic drinker. But you also say that one of the cornerstones of his leadership ability was his awareness of how alcohol affected people.
Well, he certainly, you know, he said that he would not send soldiers into battle unless they were moderately drunk. He understood very well, as Ulysses S. Grant understood later, what a useful tool alcohol could be if you're fighting a war. And, of course, the real way that he got his army through the winter at Valley Forge was by doubling the rum ration.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he knew how to use alcohol to lead his troops. And he was, you know, he was the biggest distiller in the country. Later, after he was president at Mount Vernon. Whether or not he was an alcoholic, I sort of don't think so. He doesn't seem to have had either the daring or the brashness or the defiance that, say, Ethan Allen had. But he certainly, as the father of the country, was the father of a huge amount of manufacture of liquor. And as I said, he understood well how to use liquor to manipulate armies.
Susan Cheever is with us. Her book is Drinking in America, Our Secret History. We'll take another break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the historian Susan Cheever. We're talking about her latest book, Drinking in America, Our Secret History. She's joining us from NPR in New York City. So let's talk about the story of Johnny Appleseed, which I loved. And you describe as sort of, you say it's the most smoothed over story, or one of them anyway, in American history. And this is an insight you credit to the food writer Michael Pollan. Johnny Appleseed is not going around sowing the seeds for everyone to have apples, but he's bringing the gift of alcohol to the frontier.
He is. That's what he brought to the frontier. And it's Michael Pollan's genius to have pointed this out, you know, that you can't really grow an edible apple from a seed. In order to grow an edible apple, you have to do a lot of fancy grafting.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of Johnny Appleseed with this pouch of seeds bringing happy apples to the happy frontier is just ludicrous. It doesn't work anyway. So, as again, to credit it to Michael Pollan, he realized that what Johnny Appleseed was actually bringing to the frontier was Applejack, which is a very powerful and delicious alcohol which you make from freezing hard cider and drinking what doesn't freeze. So, you know, he, of course, they all rejoiced when he arrived in town. And what he did was he'd start nurseries. And then, you know, eventually those nurseries would yield Applejack. And that's, yes, the story of Johnny Appleseed is a drinking story.
So let's talk about this era in the country. So we start with beer. We switch to rum, and we've got corn whiskey and cider and Applejack. So at this point, It's a fact of life. Drinking is a fact of life. And by the 1820s, as I was sort of mentioning in that introduction and as you write about in the book, we're sort of out of control. I mean, children are drinking, farmers are drinking, factory workers are drinking.
Everybody's drinking. I love it that the children have a drink before they go to school in the morning. I could have used that. I've got to say, I don't know about you, Doug, but it would have made school so much better. But it had, you know, it was flip, fruit juice and green alcohol. Yeah. If only my parents had just quit with the Cheerios and given me what I really needed, which was a stiff drink before I got on the school bus. But alas, I didn't grow up in the 1820s and 30s, but that's how they did it. And, you know, farmers had a jug at the end of every row, and factory workers broke twice a day for drinking. And the whole country was pretty well lit up. And, you know, a number of things happened. One is, of course, it's one thing to be drunk when you're farming and another thing to be drunk when you're on an assembly line or working in a factory. It's not so good if you're working in a factory. You make mistakes that put other people at risk. So, you know, the Industrial Revolution came along, and then slowly, and I think, you know, we're right at the edge when we're talking about 1820, 1830, we're right at the edge of what we call the American Renaissance, the flowering of New England, this tremendous sort of it was like the 1960s, the 1830s and 40s and 50s in New England. People suddenly started changing and deciding that, for instance, they had hated foreign things. They decided that foreign things were interesting. They had been very set against nature. Yeah. And nature became something to adore and revere. And, of course, there was this tremendous literary flowering, as you remember. F.O. Matheson famously said that all of American literature was written between 1850 and 1855. Melville, Hawthorne, the Alcotts, Dickinson, Longfellow, Emerson, Thoreau. You know, it's an astonishing outpouring of literary creativity and just general creativity.
And not drunks.
No, not drunks at all. I mean, that's – let me make that point.
Yeah.
Since I'm on this, this idea that great writers have to be drunks is completely incorrect. Great writers had to be drunks between 1920 and 1980.
Right.
None of America's great writers before 1920 were drunks.
Right.
Possibly Poe, you know, but all the great writers of the 19th century, all the people who wrote what we call American literature, again, Melville, Hawthorne, Longfellow, Dickinson, Thoreau, Emerson, the Alcotts, the list is long. They didn't drink. Drinking was just not a big part of their lives. Hawthorne drank a little, you know, but it wasn't a factor in the way they lived. And they certainly wrote very, very well. So my theory is that this drinking writer thing was caused by Prohibition, because it starts in about 1920, and then you've got Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Sinclair Lewis, Eugene O'Neill. You've got all the Nobel literature winners in the 20th century are drunks. And then it goes away. Our great writers now are not drunks. John Irving, Jonathan Franzen, Donna Tartt, they're not drunks.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing that it just was really for this very limited time period in the United States. And when people write about drinking writers, and they love to do that, they have to keep using the same five or six or seven writers.
Right.
One of them was my father, of course, because it only happened really between Prohibition and the end of the 20th century. Mm. So the whole idea that in order to write well, you have to drink is just completely fallacious.
Yeah.
It's not true. You can write like Emerson or Thoreau or Louisa May Alcott or Emily Dickinson without drinking, or at least they did.
Right. Abraham Lincoln, his mother, on her deathbed, made him promise not to drink. I didn't know that story.
Yes, it's a weird story because I don't think she was an alcoholic. In other words, again, they didn't have that word, alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah.
Same with the Adamses. They didn't really know what it was. But he was not an alcoholic, and he didn't drink. And in fact, he became a kind of – he wasn't a temperance crusader, but he was very friendly towards the temperance movement. He gave some very nice lectures to the Washingtonians, which were a very successful temperance group in Baltimore. And, you know, Lincoln was not a drunk, didn't drink, and yet
– didn't mind that Grant did.
Didn't mind that Grant did, understood well that it was okay for Grant to drink, but also the night Lincoln died, his bodyguard was across the street in a bar with his assassin, with John Wilkes Booth. Yeah. So drinking really hurt him in the end. And it's there's so much sadness to me in that, that, you know, this guy who didn't drink, but who also, you know, Lincoln was that rare, rare thing, a person who doesn't drink and doesn't judge.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
So, you know, famously, I think this is apocryphal, which is a fancy word for not true. I think this is apocryphal, but famously, apocryphally, Lincoln's generals came to him to complain about Grant's drinking, and he said, you know, bring me a barrel of whatever he's drinking. I want all my generals to drink it.
Yeah.
Because Grant was so successful and such a booze fighter.
Well, and McClellan couldn't get off the mark, and he was a teetotaler.
Couldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
He couldn't, and it's actually Strobe Talbot's insight that, you know, if Lincoln had not fired McClellan and hired Grant, we might all be living in a very different kind of country.
You know, I liked this in this section you're writing about Frederick Douglass, who was a drinker for a time. It was one of these ways you say that he kind of tried to ease the spiritual and physical pain that he was any slave would have been going through. But then he stops, and it was after he stopped that he began to really focus on how to get away from his situation. So it's interesting in that story that alcohol sort of plays a role in both parts of his character and the way – I mean, that seems like that's typical of the story, I guess. It plays a role for good and for ill, I suppose.
Well, in his autobiography, he says this very controversial thing, which I would never dream of saying, which is without whiskey, there would have been no slavery.
Yeah.
In other words, his theory, and he was there, so he certainly knows more than I do, was that by giving their slaves free whiskey once a week and by urging them to drink on holidays, that slave masters, plantation owners, whoever, were able to keep people enslaved in a way that if those people had been sober, they would have risen up and there would have been no slavery of the kind that we had, to our shame, in this country. So I think that's a fascinating theory, that without drunkenness, it wouldn't have been possible for people to own other people the way they did.
The temperance movement, this was an interesting section you write about. So it sort of kicks in that 1820, 1830 time.
Yes.
And, you know, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work so well. But, you know, obviously Alcoholics Anonymous has worked really well. MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, those are the sort of two of the most successful throughout history. We're sort of running out of time, and I want to get a sense of where you think we are now. But we talked a little bit about this. Where do we seem to be headed? It seems like if we have these two poles in American history, you know, where we're drinking a lot and then we are sort of trying to propose amendments to the Constitution to stop drinking entirely. Mm. It's like Americans can't find a middle ground. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't think we're a middle ground sort of people.
Right. Right, right.
And I think we're less of a middle ground sort of people than we've ever been.
Really?
Well, isn't that what, you know, isn't the polarization of this country what we're all talking about all the time now? So I'm not saying everybody's drunk, but you know, certainly middle ground is not the American way, never has been.
Mm.
But I don't know where we're going now to answer your question. We seem to be, you know, for a while we were drinking so much, and then for a while we thought drinking was bad. Now it seems to be all of the above. You know, our our treatments are more sophisticated and more successful than they've ever been. But our drinking also seems to be more sophisticated and more successful than it's ever been. I guess the one thing I want to say, I want to leave anybody with, is that the situation now, the bad part of the situation now, is that we do have treatment and it isn't available to many people who need it, either because they can't afford it or because they don't understand it or because they don't know about it. And that really I hope, can change.
One story we didn't get to, and I want you to say something about it because I thought it was so interesting. With Prohibition, you know, the question is, would women have had the vote much earlier without this idea of prohibition?
Good
How would
question.
It have affected our laws and the presidents we elected at the time? I mean, the country at that time, you said, was, this is how you put it, vibrating with anxiety about the role of women. Would you say something about that finally? Because that was really interesting.
Well, it was thought before prohibition that prohibition was going to be a good thing for women. And it got very tangled up with the issue of women's suffrage. So, you know, prohibition passed in or actually went into effect in 1920, which was the year that women got the vote.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of shocking that women didn't have the vote before 1920, I have to say. But people were wrong about that. It turned out that prohibition wasn't good for anybody. It wasn't good for women and it wasn't good for men. And the old-fashioned idea that, you know, women stayed home and men went out to bars and spent their paychecks turned out not to be true. It turns out that women can drink men right under the table if they feel like it and if it's required. And I certainly think women drink in a different way than men do. Is that going to get me in trouble? Well, if it does, it does. But, you know, drinking is drinking, as wonderful as it is when it's wonderful and as problematic as it is when it's problematic.
Susan Cheever. Her book is Drinking in America, Our Secret History. She joined us from NPR in New York. Susan, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, our thanks to Sophie Sirois. The show directed by Tim Slover. Josh Weathers produces Video West. Radio West produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.